This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, I interviewed Paul Krugman, a columnist for the New York Times and an economics professor at Princeton University. Krugman opposes President Bush's tax cuts and believes that his economic policies could send us into a spiral of fiscal collapse. Krugman said that behind Bush's economic policies is a plan to deprive the government of revenue so that it's forced to dismantle most of the federal system that's been built up since the 1930s. Krugman cited Grover Norquist as being one of the leading architects of the current administration's policies. We wanted to hear Grover Norquist's point of view, so we invited him to be our guest today on Fresh Air. He's the president of Americans for Tax Reform. He also organizes other conservative groups under the umbrella of the American Conservative Union. He founded the K Street Project, whose goal is to encourage corporate CEOs to hire lobbyists with Republican affiliations. Norquist also helped write the Republicans' 1994 Contract with America. For the past 10 years, he's presided over invitation-only, off-the-record Wednesday meetings where a group of influential conservative activists, lobbyists, journalists, scholars, and politicians gather to discuss the political issues of the day. An article in USA Today referred to Norquist's office as the incubator for Bush's political strategy. I asked Grover Norquist if he directly advises the president about tax cuts.
Well, actually, I started working with the president a couple of years before the election. I think he's fairly clear in my view and the view of the American people and the taxpayer movement, and that they'd like lower taxes. And my consistent advice is tax rates should be lower, taxes should be simpler, clearer, more visible, and that we should eliminate the double taxation of income, right, and double and triple. Right now, we tax it when you earn it, we tax it when you invest it, we tax it if it's invested inside a corporation, we tax it when it comes out as a dividend. If you're stupid enough to die, they steal half again. So we want to get the government down to taking one bite of the apple.
Now, the Bush tax cuts would cost us about $1.1 trillion over the next 10 years. And we're going to be hundreds of billions of dollars in debt. At the same time, the president wants $87 billion to rebuild Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you think we're in a tough spot, needing a lot of money to rebuild those two countries at the same time that we're cutting taxes?
Well, there's a very interesting use of the word we. Every time you use the word we, you meant the government. And I tend to use the word we to mean the American people and to speak of the government as the government. So when the government doesn't take as much of your money next year as it did last year, we have more money. The government has a lower tax rate, and depending on economic growth, may have more or less money. But we, the people, have more money. So it is a good thing for us to have lower taxes. Now, the government spends about 20% of the federal government, national government, spends 20% of the gross domestic product of the country. 20% of everything created in this country is taken by force by the government and spent. That's too high. It is historically too high, and that number needs to be reduced. And we need to both reduce the total taxes on us, the American people, and we need to reduce the spending by them, the government.
Well, you know, you're talking about we. Should we use the word we to describe our government? Well, you know, the government has invaded Iraq and fought a war in Afghanistan in our names.
And yeah, that's fair enough, in our names, but that's not the same thing. I wasn't over there. I didn't do it. We didn't do it. The U.S. government, the U.S. Army did it.
Uh-huh. But they're using your money to do it.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, I just think it's interesting that when somebody says, this tax cut costs us, where are they standing? They're standing in the shoes of the state, not the shoes of the citizenry. Tax cuts do not cost us. Tax cuts benefit us. Tax cuts may, depending on how they're structured, result in the government having fewer resources.
Now, critics of the president's tax cuts say that it's helping the wealthy a whole lot more than it's helping the middle class or people in the lower middle class. What's your argument in support of those tax cuts?
Yeah, I'm actually old enough to be rather tired of the class warfare argument. And it's nonsense on a number of scales. First of all, when you talk about rich and poor people in America, You have to ask, unlike, say, Britain of 200 years ago or Saudi Arabia today, rich and poor are not things that you tag somebody and they live with all their life. There's some new data from the Census Bureau. Of all those people who were in poverty between 1996 and 1999, that four-year period, 34% left poverty within 4 months of entering it. So a third of poor people during that period were only poor for a month, or for 4 months or less. 80% of the people who were poor during that period were poor for less than a year. Somebody loses a job, something goes wrong, they're poor, then they get a job, things, and they're not poor again. Of all the people who were poor during the entire period of 96 to 99, one out of 17 people who were ever poor were poor for the whole period. Go to rich people. This is one of the games that that the left used to play when we cut the capital gains tax. They'd say, only rich people, or mostly rich people, pay capital gains taxes, like when you sell your house. Well, guess what? If you make $30,000 a year and you sell your $100,000 house 1 year and you go back to making $30,000 a year, during the year in which you pay the capital gains tax on the house, you show up as having made $100,000. And then they say, only people who make $100,000 get a capital gains tax. It's just nonsense. People get poor, they get rich. Of the families in the lowest income quintile, the lowest fifth in 1988, for instance, half of them move to a higher quintile in the next 10 years. So they move from the bottom 20 to the between 20 and 40 or higher. 47% of those in the highest 20% drop to a lower one within 10 years. There's a tremendous amount of economic mobility. And so when people try and use the kind of rhetoric that might have been clever in East Germany in 1957, they miss that they're talking to the American people.
Okay, but we're talking about, for instance, the elimination of the estate tax. The estate tax is only paid by somebody who gets over $2 million in inheritance. So, you know, when you get out of poverty and you cross that line, which is, was it like $18,000 or something that's officially poverty line?
Depends how many kids you have, yeah.
Right, okay. So when you cross that, maybe you're making like $20,000 or something. That's not going to help you with the estate tax. I mean, you're talking $2 million. That's a line people don't cross a lot. I don't think that's...
Yeah, the good news about the move to abolish the death tax, the tax where they come and look at how much money you've got when you die, how much gold is in your teeth, and they want half of it, is that you're right. There's an exemption for, I don't know, maybe $1 million now, and it's scheduled to go up a little bit. However, 70% of the American people want to abolish that tax. Congress, the House, and Senate have three times voted to abolish it. President supports abolishing it. So that tax is going to be abolished. I think it speaks very much to the health of the nation that 70-plus percent of Americans want to abolish the death tax because they see it as fundamentally unjust. The argument that some who play to the politics of hate and envy and class division will say is, well, that's only 2% or as people get richer, 5% in the near future of Americans likely to have to pay that tax. I mean, that's the morality of the Holocaust. It's only a small percentage, you know. I mean, it's not you, it's somebody else. And this country, people who may not make earning a lot of money the centerpiece of their lives, they may have other things to focus on, they just say it's not just. If you've paid taxes on your income once, government should leave you alone, shouldn't come back and try and tax you again.
Excuse me one second. Did you just compare the estate tax with the Holocaust?
No, the morality that says it's okay to do something to a group because they're a small percentage of the population is the morality that says that the Holocaust is okay because they didn't target everybody. It's just a small percentage. What are you worried about? It's not you. It's not you. It's them. And arguing that it's okay to loot some group because it's them, or kill some group because it's them and because it's a small number, it has no place in a democratic society that treats people equally. If the government's going to do something to or for us, it should treat us all equally, And the argument that Bill Clinton used when he wanted to raise taxes in 93 was, I'm only going to tax the top 2%, so this doesn't affect the rest of you. I'm only going to get some of these guys, not you, others. The challenge there, when people use that rhetoric, in addition to the fact that I think it's immoral to separate the society by, when South Africa divided people by race, that was wrong. When East Germany divided them by income and class, that was wrong. East Germany was not an improvement over South Africa. Dividing people so that you can mug them one at a time is a bad thing to do, whether you're doing it on racial grounds, religious grounds, or whether you work on Saturdays or not grounds, not economic grounds.
So you see taxes as being, the way they are now, a terrible discrimination against the wealthy, comparable to the kind of discrimination of say, the Holocaust.
Well, you can use different rhetoric or different points for different purposes. And I would argue that those who say, don't let this bother you, I'm only doing it, the government is only doing it to a small percentage of the population, that is very wrong, and it's immoral. They should treat everybody the same. They shouldn't be shooting anyone, and they shouldn't be taking half of anybody's income or wealth when they die.
My guest is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. When all the Bush tax cuts go through and we have, billions and billions and billions of dollars less for the government to work with,
Trillions, yes.
Some tough choices will have to be made. What are you recommending that that the president cut? What kind of operations and services and so on do you think should go?
Well, I think what you have to look at in some cases is whether something that's being run by the government now needs to always be run by the government.
Mm-hmm.
This administration has proposed that we actually enact the law, which has been there since the 50s, which is if something is being done by a government employee at the national level, and it's actually available to be done through the yellow pages, like people cutting grass or serving food at a restaurant, it's not an inherently governmental task. The guys who cut the grass at the Pentagon don't have to be soldiers. They could be contractors who cut grass at the bank when they're not cutting grass at the Pentagon. There are 850,000 present government positions, government jobs, full-time jobs, for the federal government, which is almost half of all federal civilian employment, that the government itself says is not inherently governmental. We don't want the private sector being a judge necessarily, or executing people, or running, or being in the military, being a soldier. When we have begun to competitively source those jobs, and say, here's a task that the government does right now, we're going to let the private sector bid on it. And then either the present government workers reorganize themselves, come up with a way to do it less expensively, and they win the contract, which often happens, or the private sector contractor gets the job, it has resulted in a 30% reduction in the cost of providing that service. Were we to competitively source all of the available jobs that the government itself admits don't have to be done by the government, that would save $25 billion every year from now out. $25 billion. That's a start, and that's not a reduction in service. That would be an improvement in services.
The reverse way of looking at that would be that a lot of workers who have federal positions wouldn't have federal positions, and they'd be getting paid less. So it's potentially another example of how working people end up on the downside of the tax cuts, because now you're taking jobs, you're outsourcing them, those people would be paid less money. And these are also the people who aren't getting a lot of money from the tax cuts.
Well, if putting government people on government payrolls made a society or a people wealthy, the Soviet Union, East Germany, and Romania would have been very wealthy societies. In point of fact, putting people on government payrolls doesn't make the society or the people involved better off. What these competitively sourcing jobs are doing is taking a project and deciding to do it and bid it, so different people come and say, we could do that in different ways. We have the highest income in the United States per capita, and the most vibrant free market and private sector. These two go together. It's not as if something isn't done by the government that it's being done by someone in the private sector getting paid less. It's probably a bunch of people getting paid more who don't have the same work rules and who don't have some of the anti-productivity rules that some of the civil service people have put in terms of their inability to be more flexible.
You've said that over the next 25 years, you'd like to see the government shrink by half.
Yes.
What would happen in your plan to public schools, the police, firefighters, highways, and Homeland Security?
Certainly. I would like to see, and the goal of the center-right coalition in America today, is to drop the cost of government, federal, state, and local together, in half with several measures. One, total spending as a percentage of the economy. Right now, government spending is about 32% of the economy. We want to take that down to 16% of the economy over 25 years. How do you do that? You mentioned roads. Roads built by the federal government cost 30% more than they have to, because there is a racist law which was passed in the 1930s called the Davis-Bacon Act. It was designed, and the people on the floor of the House and the Senate who passed it said clearly it was designed to keep black people out of the construction industry, because blacks were moving up from the South working on highways, and they only wanted white guys to have those jobs. This Davis-Bacon Act, which requires quote-unquote prevailing wages, meaning union wages, to be paid, means that you can't have different companies bidding, and it bids up the cost of building highways by about one-third.
So what you're saying is by not paying a union wage, by lowering the wages of those workers, we could cut more taxes.
Well, we're talking. You had said, what services do you have to get rid of to drop the cost of government significantly?
Right.
And my argument is, you don't have to drop service. I'm not talking about less roads. I want more roads. Not less roads.
You're talking about lower wages. Am I reading you wrong? Just tell me, am I reading you wrong? That
no, it, well, it's not necessarily lower wages.
Less. Yeah,
because over the course of a year, mm-hmm. You're talking about people having full-time jobs for the whole year. What you do with the Davis-Bacon Act is you spike people's income for a short period, and then they go unemployed for a longer period. Mm-hmm. So I would argue that you're talking about having a wealthier and more successful set of employees in non-union construction, which is why most construction people are non-union by choice. And so the Davis-Bacon Act is an example of a law. When you compare government education and independent education in this country, independent education costs about half as much and provides a better education than government education.
Do you think we should do away with public schools?
No, I think what we should do is allow those tax dollars which flow to education to go to parents and through children, not through bureaucracies. Right now, you know, the bureaucracy of the Catholic school system in New York is a fraction per pupil of the government-run bureaucracy. I'm speaking to you from Washington, D.C. We have a very extensive and very expensive bureaucracy and a very lousy school system that does not educate children. Less than half of the money gets anywhere close to educating children. The rest goes to the bureaucracy. And we ought to be in the business of saying no money to expand the bureaucracy. Money should flow with students. This in some states and cities is done through vouchers or scholarships. And you say, look, if our city or state is going to spend $5,000 or $7,000 per kid, the money flows with the child. And that's when parents will get respect and decent treatment from the bureaucrats and the teachers in schools.
So you're basically talking about vouchers?
Well, vouchers, scholarships, I mean, all of those would make sure that the parents and the children are in control rather than the bureaucracies.
Do you think that, you know, a lot of states in the United States are complaining now that they're not getting the money from the federal government that they need for Homeland Security. How do you propose dealing with the issue of Homeland Security? And the need for that is at an all-time high at a time when cutting taxes is also at an all-time high.
Okay. It is true that some incompetent politicians at the state and local level have argued that they're not getting as much money from the federal government as they would like. It is probably true they're not getting as much money from the federal government as they would like. I am looking at a chart which shows the growth of federal grants to states in 2000, up 5%, then up 10% in 2001, up 10% in 2002, and up 15% in 2003. I know that the politicians at the state and local level who do not do their jobs well like to blame other people. So do four-year-olds. We don't put up with it in four-year-olds, and we shouldn't put up with it in incompetent mayors and incompetent governors. One of the good things about the states, and I am a Ronald Reagan Federalist, meaning I like 50 states not because they're closer to the people. That's nonsense. I'm not any closer to my governor than I am to the president. But there are 50 of them. And when they do something really stupid, you can move. You can move your money. And people do move between states when states behave badly. There's a reason people leave New York, or 20 years ago were leaving Massachusetts. Because they were providing very bad government. Why do people leave New York City in great numbers prior to Rudy Giuliani's change of crime and tax policies? So it is a good thing that states compete to provide the best government at the lowest cost. And people decide what level of government they're willing to pay for and they want.
Grover Norquist is the president of Americans for Tax Reform. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Grover Norquist. He's the president of Americans for Tax Reform and a leading advocate of cutting taxes and reducing federal spending. He also organizes other conservative groups under the umbrella of the American Conservative Union. With the kind of tax cuts that we're already getting and the additional tax cuts that you would like to see, what would you recommend happen with Social Security and Medicare?
Well, Social Security, the good news is that there's an emerging consensus in the United States that we need to do what President Bush recommended in the last campaign, and that is to begin the process of moving it from a Ponzi scheme, a pay-as-you-go scheme where you pay your Social Security FICA taxes this week, and next week it goes to pay for somebody who's retired, and there is no savings for you, there is no account for you, there is just debt. To one where you take your FICA tax, or the equivalent of your FICA tax, and put part of it, and I would like eventually to phase in all of it, into a 401k or an IRA, a personal savings account. Were we to have started 40 years ago, and said to everyone, your FICA taxes will go into a personal savings account that you can retire on, people would be retiring with hundreds of thousands of dollars in assets, including low-income people, and have much more resources each month because that money would have accumulated and increased in value over time. So the good news is that polls at 70 and 80% support, so the tremendous level of support for making that move. The younger you are, the more anxious people are to make that change because they do not believe that Social Security, as presently structured, will provide them any decent retirement. And they're right to not believe that.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think a lot of people would disagree that Ponzi scheme is an appropriate word for Social Security. I mean, it's true that the money you put into Social Security supports the generation that has already retired, and then the next generation should be putting money in that supports you and so on. That's different than a Ponzi scheme in which the people at the bottom never get any return. But, you know, there is a fear on the part of the many critics of your scheme is that, you know, first of all, unless you have money to put into these 401ks, you're not going to get much back. And there was this kind of guarantee of Social Security for working people. The stock market can fall, you can make bad investments and end up with little or nothing in the alternate scheme to Social Security. You're not concerned about that?
I am concerned that demagogues of the left will trot that out again. I'm less concerned because they've done it before and nobody's buying. The idea that your money is safe because the government has it is an interesting concept, but not one that impresses the American people. You don't have to save money in stocks and bonds. You can do it with a bank. And Social Security is only there for people who work anyway. And so it's not like you get Social Security benefits for free. If you simply take the money that was put into the FICA program on your behalf, theoretically on your behalf, and given to somebody else. If you've taken that money and invested it in a bond or in the stock market, at any time during the last 70 years, if you'd invested it at the high point and taken out at the low point, you'd still be better off than the government's present program, which is a Ponzi scheme, which is they promise to invest your money and they don't invest it. They give it to previous investors.
Just proceeding down the line here of changes that you'd like to make, what changes would you want to make in Medicare because of cut taxes?
Well, whether you cut taxes or not cut taxes, you have to reform Medicare. It's going bankrupt. I mean, Medicare, with no changes, goes bankrupt in, within the next 20 years. It's in worse shape than Social Security. It needs to be reformed, not because of any tax cuts. You can't raise taxes fast enough to save the present system. It needs to be reformed because it has got financial problems. I would suggest that we give people more options rather than have one-size-fits-all situations, which is what Medicare does. The federal government runs a program for its employees, which gives them quite a number of different options, medical savings accounts, different kinds of ways to prepay or insure for health care. At bottom, monopolies do a poor job of providing services to people at a reasonable cost. That is true whether it's the steel mill that has a government monopoly or whether it's a government retirement program or a government health care program.
So are you talking about doing away with Medicare and creating a different alternative?
Well, I wouldn't. You can play semantic games and say if you reform it and give people more options, you've done away with it. I would say leave the present program there for anyone who wants it and have alternative options if people would prefer. All of the people who want to reform Social Security say, look, leave the present system there for anyone who is uncomfortable changing anything. In any society, there's some people that just want to stay with the status quo, even if the status quo makes them poor, because they just hate risk. So if you want to stay with Social Security, you want to stay with Medicare, do so. But there should be other options that would allow people medical savings accounts, which are terribly helpful, very important. I think that people who don't want people to have options because if they had options, they wouldn't take the government monopolies program are not acting in the best interests of the people that they claim to represent.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Grover Norquist. He's the president of Americans for Tax Reform, and he has worked very closely with President Bush in formulating the tax cut plan, and he's one of the strongest advocates in America for major tax cuts. Are there any services that you think taxes should support? Do you think that the American public should be taxed to support any of the services that we have now?
Well, at the federal, at the national level, we spend right now 3.5% of GDP on defense. 3.5% GDP. All federal spending, national government spending is 20% of the economy. I think national defense is very important. I think 3.5% is probably a little high, but 2%, we could run the planet for spending 2% of GDP if we spend it competently. We were doing pretty well at 3%, and we ought to get a little more efficient and effective there. I think we can rein in spending. I think we ought to have strong economic growth over the next several years.
But in addition to defense, are there any services that the government should support?
Certainly, yes. Providing and protecting property rights, mm-hmm. Making sure that bad guys, if they steal things or shoot somebody, that they get arrested and prosecuted. I don't think that the government has to build the prisons. When you have privately built prisons, they cost half as much as when the government builds them. And there are privately run prisons in this country, too, for a lot of prisoners. So some stuff the government does can be contracted out. There are 500,000 government police in the country and 1 million private sector guards in the country. So in some senses, police protection is already 2/3 privatized. I do think a lot of arrest powers need to be in the hands of government policemen. There are a fair number of things the government can and should do. They should run national defense. They should run a police force at the state and local level. and courts to protect property rights. I mean, the reason we're rich isn't that we live in America, and it isn't that we're white or Protestant or Western or anything like that. It's because we respect property rights and we have the rule of law. And people from all over the world, of all religions, all faiths, all ethnic backgrounds, thrive under those rules. And in other countries where they don't have those rules, they're poor. So it's very important that the government protect property rights, freedom of contract, that sort of thing.
Your group, Americans for Tax Reform, has constructed something called the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, which you administer to political candidates. And the pledge reads, "I pledge to the taxpayers that I will oppose and vote against any and all efforts to increase taxes." Is cutting taxes almost like a religion to you?
No, it's an important political principle, and politics and religion are two different things and ought to be. But we have 217 members of the U.S. House who signed that pledge never to raise taxes, 42 senators, one president, 1,200-plus state legislators, and eight governors. And my goal is to get a lot more of the state legislators and a lot more of the governors. For starters, the government ought not to be taking more money from the American people, because in every city, every state, and the national level, it is today spending too much, taxing too much, and wasting too much.
You are very anti-government in a lot of ways. I mean, although you're very close to people in government and have helped many of them get elected, you at the same time seem very alienated and even opposed to a lot of facets of government. And I'm wondering, what were some of the key incidents that shaped you in that position?
Well, I'm in favor of a healthy and limited government. I mean, if you're looking at somebody with lung cancer and you say you cut the cancer out, that doesn't make you anti-lung. I want a government that protects property rights and leaves people alone and says foreigners can't come mess with us and criminals shouldn't and can't come mess with us. Those are legitimate functions of a government. Beyond that, the government becomes abusive. It becomes tyrannical. And I guess there's some, but even completely tyrannical governments provide some services, but that doesn't justify the tyranny.
When Paul Krugman was on Fresh Air last month, the New York Times economics columnist, he described the Bush administration as revolutionaries because of all the things they wanted to change in America, including the cutting of taxes and the cutting of many government programs. Do you think of yourself as a revolutionary?
Well, the good thing about being an American conservative is that you can be both traditionalist and revolutionary, because European conservatives are people who think that everybody on this side of the river is a good guy and everybody on that side of the river is a bad guy, or that my religion's better than your religion, or we like the king, or something stupid like that. American conservatism harkens back to our American tradition, which is one of armed resistance to the central government. It is a very revolutionary idea. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were and are revolutionary documents in the course of human history, the idea that people should be free and independent and autonomous to the point where they should be armed, and that the government ought not to be pushing people around and has no divine right to mess with you and shove you around and steal your money and steal your property and tell you what to do or what church or synagogue or mosque to go to. These are very revolutionary ideas.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Take it easy.
Grover Norquist is the president of Americans for Tax Reform.